I'm sure you'll know the name Lisa Wilkinson. It hasn't exactly been smooth sailing for the veteran journalist over the past few years. Accepting the Logie Award for Most Outstanding News Coverage or Public Affairs Report for her interview with former Liberal Party staffer Brittany Higgins about her alleged sexual assault in Parliament House should have been a high point. Instead, it was the moment that Lisa's once unsinkable career began taking on water. Pretty soon, she was forced to resign from the project. She faced defamation action from Bruce Lehrman and ended up suing Network 10 for nearly $2 million in legal costs. But at a time when every day felt like she was rowing against the tide, Lisa was thrown a lifeline from another sinking ship, a pretty famous one. The Titanic story of Evelyn is the story of the only Australian survivor of the sinking of the Titanic, and it's a story that Lisa Wilkinson felt she had to tell. Let's start when Lisa first heard of Evelyn driving down the freeway with husband Peter Fitzsimmons by her side, and she's in conversation with fellow journalist and author Cassie Hamer.
My husband is a very passionate writer, so I became the driver, and he sat there, as he always does, with his computer open on his lap, and I heard him say, "Isn't she a beauty?" I said, "Sorry, what? Isn't she a beauty?" And he was pointing to his open laptop where there was a picture. And I quickly looked over because I was driving, but it didn't take me long to say, "Oh, is that a picture of the Titanic?" And he said, "Yeah, isn't she a beauty?" And I said, "Well, she was. Probably not so much these days." And I put my eyes back on the road and I just had a thought, a passing thought. I said, "Have you ever checked to see if there are any Australians on the Titanic? Because, I don't know, maybe there's an incredible story there that you could tell in your next book." And he said, "That's a great idea. I've never thought about it." And I said, "Well, you've got 40 years in journalism. I've got 40 years in journalism. How is it that in 80 years you and I have never thought about whether there were any Australians? We decided there probably weren't, because if there were, we would know them." And I said, "Anyway, you should look into it." A couple of days went by and I said to him on the Monday morning, "So did you check that Titanic story?" And he said, no, but I will." At the time, I was in the middle of a pretty horrendous court case and spending way too much time with lawyers for my own good. And I had a sudden thought, "I've got a computer. I've heard of that thing called Google." So I looked it up, and to my absolute amazement, there were actually 6 Australian-born passengers and crew on the Titanic, but only 1 Australian-born survivor. An absolutely kick-ass nurse from an hour and a half north of Adelaide, youngest of 5 children of the local station master at Hoyleton. And when I looked into what little there was on the internet about her, I realised very quickly this was an extraordinary young woman, and it was no coincidence through the talents that she had that she survived. And I rang Pete and I said, "Oh my God, you have to make this your next book." I put some dot points together, emailed it to him. He sent that email to his publisher, and about an hour and a half later, I got a call from his female publisher. He had 2 at the time. Vanessa called me. And she said, "Lisa, everyone is talking about this amazing idea for one of Pete's books that you've sent through." And I said, "Isn't it just the perfect book for Pete?" And she said, "Well, no, not really." And I'll clean up what I said next, but it was along the lines of, "Are you insane? This is the best story that has never been told. You have to do this book." And Vanessa, who is here today, won't mind me repeating, she said, "Lisa, it is going to be an amazing book, but it's not going to be a Pete book. It's going to be a Lisa book." And I said, "Vanessa, I love you, always have, always will. I really appreciate your support and your belief, but I've got way too much going on in my life at the moment. I don't have the emotional energy to be able to do this." And she said, "Lisa, you do. And I'm just going to leave that thought with you, okay? And I'll give you a call in a few days." Well, Vanessa didn't wait a few days. Vanessa waited exactly 3 hours. Because 3 hours after that phone call, news of the Ocean Gate submersible broke around the world on its journey to look for the Titanic. So Vanessa called me and she said, have you read the news? And I said, I have read the news, Vanessa. And she said, how are you feeling right now? And I said, I think Evelyn and I are about to go on a journey.
And what a journey it proved to be. Let's talk a little bit more in detail about Evelyn and her life. As you mentioned, she was essentially born into a tiny dot town out of Adelaide in the outback. She had one of those typical bush childhoods of spending her weekends roaming the countryside on her favourite horse, Tigger. And then of a holiday time, she would go and spend her holidays with some family at Murray Bridge, where she learnt a very important skill. What was that?
Well, it turned out to be a bit of a superpower, as you can imagine, given she was on the Titanic. That was where she learnt to row. And that rowing did come in very handy later. But as a teenage girl, she used to row with a number of other rowers on the Murray River. But Evelyn, as was typical, I discovered, of Evelyn, Evelyn always wanted to challenge herself, and she didn't want to row like the other rowers, which was to get in the boat and then row with the current, and when the tidal flow turned, safely, gently come back to shore. Evelyn always wanted to challenge herself, and so Evelyn would always row against the tide. And when I heard those words, particularly at the point I was in my life, I thought, I wonder how many Australian women feel like they're regularly rowing against the tide. And that really marked for me the sort of woman I was starting to learn about.
She really was a woman in many ways who was ahead of her time. We're talking about the turn of the century, where options for women are very limited. They've only really just achieved the vote.
And so, only the second place in the world to achieve the vote for women.
So a very progressive place is Adelaide. But essentially, Evelyn's choices would have been, one, get married, have children, two, become a governess, three, become a nurse. She chose option three. So she became a nurse at the Royal Adelaide Hospital. And then an opportunity came her way to accompany one of her patients on a voyage to the UK. An opportunity that she really seized upon and then had quite a remarkable career of traversing the world.
She had always dreamt of elsewhere, and that was partly informed by her oldest brother, Tommy. She hero-worshipped Tommy. She used to go horse riding with him, and Tommy went away to war. And there's a moment early in the book where you will discover what it was in many ways that propelled Evelyn to be a woman who always wanted to give back, to serve others, to help others. And so for Evelyn, dreaming of elsewhere, I think, was partly informed by seeing Tommy off to war. And so when she got to London and, you know, her passage had been paid for by accompanying this elderly patient, she just suddenly realised how exciting elsewhere was. Mm. So she signed up as a nurse stewardess on cruise ships travelling the world. And it was while she was on one of these cruise ships that she met and fell in love with and became engaged to a handsome ship's doctor, William Abel James. And so together they were travelling the world.
It's quite an incredible love story because you get the sense that Evelyn wasn't the kind of woman who had her heart set on marriage and children, and yet this is what fell into her lap. The connection is undeniable to the point where the two of them sign up to work on the Titanic, but fate steps in a pretty significant way.
So they're both thrilled. They are both told, yes, William, you will be one of the two ship's doctors on the Titanic, and Evelyn, you will be a nurse stewardess in first class. And so to be on what was, without a doubt, the most famous voyage that to that point was ever going to take place, was just a dream come true, because they then planned that they would marry in Southampton, and I've been to the church and it's one of the most beautiful churches I've ever had the enormous privilege of walking into. It is such a beautiful space. So they were going to get married in the July, and the Titanic was sailing in early April of 1912. So their future was all mapped out until, with just days to go, William is told, sorry, scheduling issues mean that you're not now going on the Titanic. You are going on the Macedonia, which is sailing to Sydney. And so Evelyn sailed alone.
Fortuitous, as we are about to talk about. Let's go to that moment in April 1912. Titanic is going hell for leather to New York on a mission to beat all speed records, ignoring every warning about icebergs in the area. Honestly, there were moments in that book I wanted to scream at the officers for ignoring them. They hit the iceberg just before midnight. Within 1 hour, the first lifeboats are being lowered down. The captain, in his wisdom, had actually cancelled the drills to get into the lifeboat. So this is an excruciating process. But to zero in on what was happening for Evelyn, she's roused. She starts helping all the passengers on board. At 1:35 a.m., she's encouraged by a very rich elderly woman, Ida Strauss, to get into the lifeboat, to take Ida's place, because Ida has been married for 50 years to her husband and she will not be separated from him. She says, so we have lived together, we will die together. And so the policy is that only women are allowed in the lifeboat. Ida gives up her place for Evelyn, but Evelyn doesn't take it. So we have to go a further hour forward. The lights of the ship that you can see on this poster are disappearing one by one. Everyone knows who's on board that this ship now is going down. You know, the mighty unsinkable is going to sink. And finally, Evelyn is directed into a lifeboat. Who told her to get in and who was around her as she got into that boat?
So there were only a few lifeboats left at this stage. I mean, remember, this is a ship that had the capacity for 3,000 passengers. That is how many people were waiting in New York on the return journey to go from New York back to Southampton. On the maiden voyage, there were 2,200 passengers. And so there's only 20 lifeboats. So for 3,000 passengers, there were enough lifeboat spots for just 1,176 people. So one of the last lifeboats, lifeboat 16, is just about to be lowered to the water. There's only a couple of spots left. Evelyn has been tirelessly resisting getting into any of the lifeboats, taking any of those spots. She's just constantly reassuring women who are being separated, torn apart from their husbands, their teenage sons, and she's securing their life belts and making sure that they're in there comforting them. Someone has been watching her for some time, witnessing this incredibly selfless woman, and steps up to her, an older gentleman, and says, get in that lifeboat. And she says, thank you very much. No, I'm just helping the women and children at this point, and I'm crew. I am very happy to just stay here and make sure we can get all the women and children into the lifeboats. And he says, my name is J. Bruce Ismay. I own the Titanic. Get in that lifeboat. Now, I am convinced, knowing Evelyn the way I have got to know her through writing this book, that there is only one way that Evelyn said yes to getting into that lifeboat. Remember that superpower she's got, rowing against the tide? Well, everyone in those lifeboats is being told, as soon as you hit the water, and hit the water they did, it was a very inexact science, lowering the lifeboats down on a sinking ship. They are told you have to row as quickly as possible to get away from the area because anything that is in the vicinity of this ship, which is just about to go down, those 52,000 tonnes that are now going to be filled with water are going to suck everything down with it. But Evelyn knew, looking at those oars, that she will be able to row like she's never rowed before, and she does.
So I think this might be the right moment for you to do a short reading from the book, if you wouldn't mind,
sure.
Which relates exactly to this moment in time.
Just to set this scene up, so Evelyn and one of her, fellow stewardesses, Violet Jessop, who wrote an incredible memoir when she was still alive that was purely intended for her family, explaining what her experience on the Titanic was like. It was subsequent to her death released as a book by her family, and the pictures she paints in that book of what it was like to be a stewardess on the Titanic was so vivid and really helped inform me about what that experience was like for both of them, because both Evelyn and Violet had been on a number of ships together, including Titanic's sister ship, also owned by J. Bruce Ismay, also owned by Captain Smith, and which also had a massive accident at sea shortly beforehand. So, you know, you can look at it and think this was all very predetermined. So we're in Lifeboat 16. Evelyn is on the oars, and Violet, like a number of people who were in the lifeboats, has been handed a tiny baby. Parentage completely unknown. As I said, families were being torn apart. There was so much chaos. So Violet is trying to keep this baby alive. Evelyn is no longer rowing. Like the others, the oars rest across her lap and between her knees, still wet from the frantic push they'd made to get clear. Now, in the middle of this freezing ocean, silence settles over Lifeboat 16 like a funeral shroud. The baby finally has stopped crying. She lies curled in Violet Jessop's arms, swaddled in a steward's coat, breathing in shallow little puffs, barely moving. They are out far enough now to stop, at least for the moment. The creaking of oarlocks has ceased and the murmurs have died away. What remains is only the sound of breath. Gasping, ragged, staggered, drawn in and out by sailors and passengers alike who cannot believe what they are seeing. Titanic's bow is beneath the water's surface. The stern tilts upward at a degree that renders the whole scene uncanny, even from afar. Deck lights at the rear of the ship, which remain above water, still glow, row upon row, turning the ship into a floating half-palace lit for a ball nobody will survive. From the lifeboat, Evelyn sees what she thinks are shadows moving across the lit portholes. Not shadows, people. Can she see some frantically waving? She's lower than when we left, Violet Jessop says quietly beside her. Much lower. Evelyn nods. She can feel it in her stomach, that pull downward. It seems to grip her soul just as it grasps that of the ship. She's still going, and yet no one can look away. Do you think she'll stay afloat? A woman whispers. She's not built to break, a crewman mutters in reply, but his voice carries no confidence. It takes all his courage to muster speech. And so Violet and Evelyn sit in horror, floating, waiting, hoping, watching.
That's beautiful. Thank you, Lisa. So, listening to that, you get the sense of the viscerality of the writing, but the trauma. We can all imagine the trauma that Evelyn experienced. And so I guess it's no surprise that when she came back to Australia, she didn't particularly want to speak about her experience. I think she only ever gave two interviews about what had happened on the ship. She grew very thin after it. And I think, you know, in modern parlance, we would say that she had a form of PTSD. So imagine, Lisa, approaching the book. One of the huge challenges was how to inhabit Evelyn's voice. But this is where fate, again, I think, stepped in. And you got to meet Evelyn's great niece, Petrea. What were Petrea's thoughts on you writing a book about her great-aunt, and what did she share with you about her great-aunt's story?
Being able to connect up with Petrea was such a gift, because Petrea is the keeper of all of Evelyn's documents, letters between her and William, letters with other members of the family, because Evelyn and William never had children. But she had a number of nieces and nephews, and Mavis was her favourite niece, and she used to come to Bondi, where Evelyn and William settled in Curlewis Street in Bondi, and Mavis would come and stay with Evelyn and William. So Petrea is Mavis's daughter. So she has all of the family folklore, and when I first contacted her, she was very wary. Because I'm a journalist, and I totally get that, more than you would know. So it took a little bit of convincing, but I think she worked out very early, and I worked out very early, that both of us were in love with Evelyn. And she knew how much care I was going to take and how precious all of the documentation was. So, you know, to have that direct connection with Evelyn has informed so much of how I've written the book. And one of the loveliest moments that I had with Petrea, of the many, was when I called her to let her know who was going to launch the book. Because when my husband Peter said to me just a few months ago, who was I going to get to launch the book, my first reaction was, I don't really know any boaty people. And I feel like I need a woman from South Australia who's always rowed against the tide. Oh, my God, Julia Gillard. So I emailed Julia with a rough outline of, I don't know if you've ever heard of this incredible woman from South Australia, but here's a few dot points. She got straight back to me and said, oh, my God, Lisa, how do we not know this woman's incredible story? Of course I'll launch your book. And then in capital letters, let's do this, with 13 exclamation marks behind it. So to call Petrea and say, Evelyn's story is going to be launched by our only ever female Prime Minister, we both cried.
Ah, go Jules. There's some lovely words at the start of the book where your publisher, Vanessa, says to you, I think Evelyn was sent to heal you. And you say that she has. And you've mentioned a couple of times the fact that Evelyn did come to you at possibly the most difficult time in your professional career, one in which you're embroiled in a lengthy legal drama, all of it stemming from an interview that you'd done on the project with a young political staffer by the name of Brittany Higgins. Can you tell me a little bit about the kind of solace you found of retreating into Evelyn and her life story? And what do you mean when you say that she healed you?
One of the greatest privileges as a journalist for me has always been the opportunity to help tell other people's stories. And in my case, to particularly help tell other women's stories. So to come across what I think is one of the greatest untold stories in Australian history, and let's not forget, less than 1% of our history is written about women. So there are so many great stories out there still to be told. But to be gifted this story that I think is a real reflection of how the world was changing for women during that first rise of the suffragettes, just felt like this is a story I'm meant to tell. There's a reason why I have this space around me where I can tell it. So it felt like the right project at exactly the right time. And to disappear into somebody else's magnificent story and to be able to champion a woman who I firmly believe would never have championed herself felt like a gift.
I've heard you speak in interviews lately about this last 4 years of your life and the incredible way that you have been tested. I've never met you until today, but I felt like I know you because you were in my living room on an almost daily basis for about 15 years.
Sorry, and I wasn't even invited, so...
Apologies. You're welcome. We turned on the TV, don't worry. But then suddenly you weren't. And that was quite a shock, I can imagine, much more for you, but also for your audience who watch along and care for you and feel like they know you. Having been tested in this way, in some of the worst ways that some could imagine, for a journalist to become the story is the most excruciating thing, I think, that a person can go through. What have you learned about yourself over these past few years?
That I believe in the truth finally being told, and that sometimes it's a pretty hard battle to get the truth told. But 2 weeks before, well, 2 weeks before today, in fact, just a couple of days before the book was launched, the court case was finally thrown out. So we know the truth of what happened that night in Parliament House. That was a very important moment for me. And closing that door and opening the Evelyn door feels like it was all meant to happen like this. So I knew right at the beginning of this battle, of the court battle, that I had to stay in the fight. I didn't have any choice because I wanted that truth to be revealed, and it has been. So it was worth the battle because I knew survivors of sexual assault were watching this case very, very closely, helping determine whether or not their voice mattered, whether their experience mattered, whether the wider world cared about women's safety. So I knew how important that fight was, and I'm proud of myself for staying until the end and seeing it through. And I've learnt that I want to keep telling women's stories.
Evelyn and her dear William are laid to rest not that far from here at the Waverley Cemetery, which, if any of you know, clings to the cliffs above Clovelly. It's an extraordinary view straight out to the ocean. Lisa, you made a promise to yourself that you wouldn't visit until a certain point. What was that point? What did you take with you, and how did you feel when you visited?
So throughout this writing process, I was obviously clinging on to everything of Evelyn that I could possibly find. I've walked in her footsteps in Southampton. You know, I've done every Titanic museum and exhibition in recent years. And the one thing that I resisted doing when I found out that Evelyn is buried at Waverley Cemetery was going to her grave. In many ways, because I feel so honoured to be the one telling Evelyn's story, and because I was so overwhelmed at the size of this task, thank you, Vanessa, that I, you know, right throughout the writing, I just kept thinking, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I'm doing Evelyn justice. I don't know if I'm doing justice to everyone who lost their lives. And I was constantly keeping myself in check. You know, do not think that you've nailed this. Do not think that you've got this right. And until you get to the end and your publisher and your editor and even your husband can say, yep, you did it. So until I got that feedback, I wouldn't allow myself to go and stand at her gravesite because I knew how moving that moment was going to be. Here I go again. So it was just before we hit publish that I went to the gravesite. I just took a single white rose. And in fact, we filmed it because everybody knew what a big moment this was for me, but I also wanted to remember it for the rest of my life. So if you want to have a look, it's on my Instagram. I was there in the early morning light because I wanted to feel something of the dawn of a new day, and being with Evelyn and being close to her, being in her presence, felt like the dawn of a new day for me. It was a very special moment.
I'm going to throw the floor open to our audience if you have some questions for Lisa that you'd like to ask, because if not, I certainly have more.
So, Lisa, when you were doing the research with technology in the way that it's now basically able to recreate itself, are we going to then create our own mythology based on something like the Titanic?
That's a big question.
Tragically, probably yes. I find what's going on at the moment terrifying for truth-telling, for journalism, for our children and our children's children. I wish I knew the answer. I just know that a world that is run by billionaires who are only motivated by making the next buck is not a healthy world.
Do you think the lifeline that Evelyn got on the Titanic was a lifeline for you as well? And does that mean that you're going to pursue another path through discovering this?
Well, the common denominator throughout my career in journalism is helping to tell other people's stories. I became very sick of seeing my own face and name in the press. I became very sick of myself. I became sick of other people's decided narrative of who I was. So to be able to tell the truth about other women, and for me to disappear into other people's stories and see the worth in that, feels like a really worthwhile career decision that I've made.
Could I ask why Vanessa was sure that Peter couldn't write the book and gave it to Lisa?
Because my beautiful husband has so many story ideas. He pretty much racks them and stacks them. Like, he's literally got five books. His next five books, he's already worked out what they are. And so I think for Vanessa, it was partly she knew what his schedule was going to be like anyway, and she wants all of those books sooner rather than later. But I think Vanessa also knew that maybe with my history of female storytelling, that maybe my level of empathy was a good place for me to be putting my energies into. That said, Pete did a brilliant book on Nancy Wake, the most decorated heroine of the Second World War. I think that book has sold to date 300,000 copies. So can tell a gal's story, just quietly. But I thank Vanessa for her belief in me.
The appendix in the back is huge.
The epilogue?
Yeah.
Of what happened to everyone after the Titanic.
Yep.
That was, in fact, one of my favourite parts of the book to write.
Yep.
Because I had to write this book without judgment. Even though there was a lot of human failure, I have not written it in a way where I'm getting angry at anyone.
Yep.
I just had to lay down the facts of exactly what happened. Most particularly, I didn't want to judge anyone in what they did when they were facing what seemed like certain death, because none of us would know how we would deal with that moment where we are facing death in the eye. But to then have a look at the lives of all those who survived, many of whom had to deal with survivor guilt. You know, out of 2,200, just over 2,200, just over 700 people survived. How they dealt with, how they faced that moment, who they lost, what the world thought of them, is so informative, but also often very heartbreaking. I found that very informative going forward, writing that epilogue. So much of it is sad, but also the magnificence. Watch out for the suffragettes on the ship. There was 434 women on that ship. The collective magnificence of so many of those kick-ass women who were on there, and by pure happenstance, three of the leading suffragettes in the world at the time all end up in Lifeboat 6. That poor Officer Hitchens, who was meant to be in charge of Lifeboat 6, never had a chance. It is such a magnificent moment. Those three women, Molly Brown, Elsie Bowman, and Helen Candy, and what they did for fighting for the right for women to get the vote in both the US and the UK is fabulous. The US got it in 1920. The UK didn't get it until 1928, which, if you can believe it, is 10 years after women could actually be voted into Parliament. So they could be voted into Parliament, but they couldn't even vote, which is just crazy. And Elsie Bowman was the first female barrister to ever appear at the Old Bailey. I mean, their stories are incredible. And the unsinkable Molly Brown, who is played by Kathy Bates in James Cameron's movie, she is fabulous. And she runs for political office. And this is a millionaireess. She starts the Titanic Survivors Committee, which is mostly focused on looking after the women who were in steerage, in third class, who almost exclusively were widowed that very night and had many children. They had nothing and they were on their way to the new world in America. And she started that survivors committee and looked after those women. She became a nurse in the First World War, millionaireess woman, like she's got more money than God, and she goes off to work in the First World War on the front line. And she then goes on to run for office, and there's the most fabulous, it almost looks like a comic, but it's an article about Molly Brown. And the headline is, so she's running for office. So this tells you where women are up to at this point. Possible female senator can run, swim, and play polo and eat with chopsticks.
I was in Halifax in Canada, and I found a number of Sydney University people who had lost their lives.
Arthur Gordon McRae from Chatswood.
Exactly.
One of the Australians.
And I wondered if you'd looked at a number of other Australians who were buried overseas from the Titanic.
Yes, I have looked at the other Australians who were on the ship. They form part of the epilogue, although Bertie Nichols, who came from Lord Howe Island, he is a fabulous character in the book, Bertie Big Neck Nichols. His actions are so heroic on the ship. Obviously, he didn't survive. Arthur Gordon McRae didn't survive. So I do talk about them, but Bertie Nichols is probably the most significant Australian character throughout the book. And he's wonderful and he deserves to be acknowledged.
Congratulations, Lisa. I just think that you always stand up for what is right. You push it through politics, you push it through media, and you succeed. And I see you as a figurehead there, pushing for us women, so to speak, but most important, for making sure that the truth comes out. So congratulations and thank you for what you do.
Thank you very much. Well said. Thank you for that. In so many ways, it's the dawn of a new chapter for you, and we are all the beneficiaries of that. Lisa Wilkinson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cassie. Thank you, everyone.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.